Welcome to Angels and Seerstones presents Demons and Pendulums, a podcast on Chad Daybell. I'm Christopher James Blythe, and I'm a professional folklorist with a specialty in supernatural legend and Latter-day Saint studies. My day job is as an assistant professor at Brigham Young University. Ordinarily, this channel is devoted to Angels and Seerstones, a Latter-day Saint folklore podcast, which is designed to be uplifting and to encourage Latter-day Saints to recognize the depth of their incredible culture and to celebrate our traditional stories. That's what I love. But in this 9-part limited series, I use my expertise to help us understand one of the most notorious acts of the 21st century, the killings of 7-year-old J.J. Vallow, 16-year-old Tylee Ryan, Charles Vallow, and Tammy Daybell. I'll discuss how these murders relate to the Latter-day Saint faith and beyond. It turns out murderers have justified their crimes by pointing to the supernatural for a very, very long time. Friends, if you haven't listened to the first episode of Demons and Pendulums, where I explain who I am and what makes this podcast different than the dozens of other explorations of the Chad and Lori Daybell murders, I hope you'll listen to that before or after you listen to this episode. It's short and it's worth your time. This limited series is in part a fundraiser for Angels and Seerstones. Christine and I are fortunate to have nearly sufficient funding this year to cover our podcast costs. It doesn't look like we will be fully covered for 2025, however, so we are taking donations during the summer of 2024 to put towards our software and recording costs. Anything extra will go towards advertising. We have no intention of taking a salary. And if you want to donate, you can just do so by Venmo, which is at Angels and Seerstones. Heads up, this podcast is in part about murder. That said, I won't be focusing on the physical evidence or the method by which people were killed. It's all too dark for me. In this episode, I consider the, quote, Mormon elements of the crimes. I have 2 points I want to make. First, the ideas that Chad Daybell used to orchestrate the murders of his wife, Lori Vallow's 2 children, and Lori Vallow's husband, were Latter-day Saint inflected. Yet as much as they drew from LDS foundations and LDS vocabulary, they were fringe and they were novel. The average Latter-day Saint would be shocked to hear about these doctrines. They would see them as entirely incompatible with their beliefs. Instead, Daybell's ideas were a variant of a new demonology showing up in certain LDS circles, and of course, not promoted by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But elements did show up in some circles of apocalyptic enthusiasts, the fringe of the fringe. I'll discuss these influences in this broader community in future episodes. My second point is that the way that the Daybells justified murder through appealing to a complex supernatural theology is old and cross-cultural. Accusations that someone is in league with or has been taken over by some otherworldly evil shows up in the Philippines and Africa, obviously in 17th century Salem, Massachusetts, and as we will see, in European cultures. Today, you'll learn about changelings in Ireland, Scandinavia, and Germany. Let's make sure we have a good grasp on Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow's beliefs on zombies before we get into this broader conversation. One document that tells us about Chad and Lori's beliefs about zombies is from Ian Pawlowski, who is the husband of Lori's niece, Melanie. Let's go over this and maybe make sense of what was going on in Chad's theology. This is what Ian wrote. The heading is zombies, and then it's broken down in different letters. So A, human bodies that have had their original spirits forced from them and have been possessed by either a demon, the original third of the heavenly host who followed Lucifer, disembodied spirits, once living human spirits who have chosen not to be reborn into another probation, or a worm/slug, a creature controlled by Lucifer that enters the body to control the host. B. Spirits can be pushed from their bodies during traumatic events or deadly injury. C. Spirits pushed out are trapped in limbo as the body they're tied to is still living, but cannot be occupied by them anymore. D. Spirits trapped in limbo cannot progress to a new mortal life and cannot re-enter their existing body. The only way to move forward is to await the death of their current, possessed body. E. This is an illegal action against heavenly law performed by the possessor. No contemporary or historic Latter-day Saint communities have held Daybell's concept of zombies. Evil spirits tempt, they deceive, they can even assault or possess a person temporarily. Yet Daybell taught that an evil force could entirely oust a person's spirit, or possess them at the moment of death to permanently take over their bodies. Daybell was aware this contradicted Latter-day Saint theology, so explained that Satan was breaking God's laws in doing so. Things were different now because the time before the second coming was so brief. Yet this realization changed the meaning of exorcism altogether. Chad and Lori's goal was not typical of an exorcist who seeks to expel a demon so that a person can continue their lives unfettered. A zombie was a possessed body that could not be freed. So the new purpose of an exorcism is to bring about death so that the body would die and allow the original spirit to move on from limbo, where they remain during the possession. When a zombie was exorcised, Chad and Lori knew they were successful only when the host died. Ian Pawlowski explained that bodies could be possessed by three kinds of evil entities. We saw this. Demons, who were the original third of the heavenly host who followed Lucifer. Two, disembodied spirits, once living human spirits who have chosen not to be reborn into another probation. Or three, a worm slug, a creature controlled by Lucifer that enters the body to control the host. This is in such stark contrast to what modern Latter-day Saints would think of when someone said they encountered evil spirits. For them, it is only the, quote, demons, or those who never possessed physical bodies, who would seek to possess someone. This was not always the case, however. Early Latter-day Saints seem to have spent more time speaking of the second category, ghosts. The third category has never been discussed in mainstream Latter-day Saint thought, but is discussed in what I would call the new demonology of some fringe LDS writers. Chad and Lori came to believe that the world was full of zombie. Lori and a small group of her friends and relatives would meet together to perform a remote exorcism to try to expel these creatures. Lori would then consult with Chad, who would applaud the group on their successes in wiping out a certain number of zombies. He figured out how many were killed in their efforts with the aid of a pendulum. There were tens of thousands throughout the world, and for the most part, these could be dealt with spiritually. Yet for some reason, the zombies that showed up around Chad and Lori, those embodied in their family members, required a more active hand. Before the murder of Charles Vallow, Chad told Lori that her husband was possessed with an evil spirit. Like exorcists throughout history, Chad tried to acquire the demon's name. This has been standard practice since antiquity. Remember that when Jesus exorcised a possessed man in the Gospels, he asked for the demon's name, and the demon responded. He said, "Legion, for we are many." In Charles Vallow's case, the first entity that possessed his body was Garrett. Next, Ned Schneider, and finally, Hiplos. We don't know the details about these intelligences. Names like Ned and Garrett make me think that these were the names of once living men. Hiplos is a different kind of name. It's got the ring of a more ancient evil. Before the murder of J.J. Vallow, Lori told her friends and house guests Melanie Gibb and David Warwick that the 7-year-old had recently become a zombie. She had encouraged them to see his behavior as particularly odd. Lori claimed he had climbed onto the refrigerator and knocked over a picture of Jesus, and then climbed onto a higher cabinet. I suppose Lori wanted them to imagine something out of an exorcism movie, with lots of bizarre ceiling climbing and blasphemy. That JJ was a 7-year-old with an autism diagnosis didn't come into the conversations. Although Melanie Gibb would later tell police that when she looked at JJ that day, he sure seemed like the same child she knew. Like many little ones his age, JJ could be prone to mood swings and the occasional tantrum. This is the way Chad and Lori set up their understanding of zombies, assuring those around them and themselves that their loved ones and those they didn't know had been taken over by evil entities. Let's put that in context with a long history of changeling belief. A traditional European belief associated particularly with Scandinavia and the British Isles holds that supernatural creatures might kidnap a person and replace them with a duplicate. These creatures were trolls, or fairies, or even demons. The imposters would replace a child with their own offspring or take the child's place themselves. Unsuspecting parents would raise the supernatural freeloader as their own. And this is usually the motive. The creature wants someone to take care of them or their offspring. But while fairies might look like children, They don't behave like children. In traditional Irish folklore, parents might realize they have a changeling in their homes when a visitor recognizes their child's odd behavior, a new illness, uncharacteristic talents, or when the child unintentionally reveals that they're actually much, much older than they seem. In folklore, if it's a baby, it doesn't grow, and it might have a beard. Whether in its true form, the changeling is a juvenile troll or an ancient fairy, they are ravenous, eating you out of house and home. Meanwhile, your child has been abducted and being raised among trolls or fairies, and the only way to get them back is to rid yourself of your changeling. The fairies are aware of how you treat the changeling, though, and will punish your loved one for any harm that comes to their friend. There were, according to legend, various ways to figure out whether your kiddo was actually a phony. Some would boil eggshells. When you do so, the creature is supposed to jump up, acknowledge how old they are, and that they have never seen such strange cooking. But usually, you get rid of these creatures with fire. One prominent story claims that you should come into the home and pronounce that the local fairy fort, the locations the Irish believed housed fairy communities, was on fire. The changeling would leap up, declare that that's where he kept his possessions and loved ones, and go running for them. But in many stories, the threat of fire is used against the fairy itself. Changeling lore seems to have been used as a justification for infanticide. We know in a few incidents that it was justification for domestic abuse. Certainly, it would have led to neglect and harassment, if not physical abuse. Identifying someone as a changeling could explain some sort of developmental delay or autism, a new sickness, depressions, or estrangement in marriage. There are so many different stories I could share right now, but I think we should talk about the most famous murder of an alleged changeling, which happened in Ireland in March 1895. Bridget Cleary had been sick with bronchitis for several days when her husband, Michael Cleary, and Bridget's father determined that Cleary was no longer herself. They believed that if they could chase off the imposter fairy, that their loved one would return triumphantly on a white horse. After some efforts from folk healers and doctors, Michael Cleary arranged for a Catholic priest to perform communion, which some claim she had refused to swallow. While the priest believed this was just an ill woman, Michael Cleary insisted the changeling had deceived them. He would try to force her to eat bread and jam later that evening, and ultimately, when Bridget was unable due to her illness to swallow, he picked up a burning log from the fire. He would set the alleged changeling ablaze. You can read more about this case in Angela Burke's book, The Burning of Bridget Cleary. Sometimes changeling lore isn't about fairies and trolls, but it's about demons. The father of the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther, would declare that he met such a changeling. Here's his account. 8 years ago, in the year 1532, at Dessau, I, Dr. Martin Luther, saw and touched a changeling. It was 12 years old, and from its eyes and the fact that it had all of its senses, one could have thought that it was a real child. It did nothing but eat. In fact, it ate enough for any four peasants. It ate, it defecated, and pissed. And whenever someone touched it, it cried. When bad things happened in the house, it laughed and was happy. But when things went well, it cried. It had these two virtues. I said to the princes of Anhalt, if I were the prince or ruler here, I would throw this child into the water, into the Mulde that flows by Dessau. I would dare commit homicide on him. But the Elector of Saxony, who was with me at Dessau, and the princes of Anhalt did not want to follow my advice. Therefore I said, then you should of all Christians repeat the Lord's Prayer in church, that God may exorcise the devil. They did this daily at Dessau, and the changeling child died in the following year. Such a changeling child is only a piece of flesh. It has no soul. Of course, the parallel between this story and the murders orchestrated by Chad Daybell are very close. I doubt Chad would have known this history about fairies or changelings. Rather, these beliefs have a way of recurring across history. Let's talk about the 21st century. I'm going to tell you about three cases that have similar stories to the Daybell killings. In 2021, Matthew Taylor Coleman murdered his 2-year-old son and 10-month-old daughter because they had reptilian, or what he called serpent DNA, and would eventually develop into evil personified. If you have followed the murders associated with the internet prophetess Sherry Schreiner, you know Matthew Taylor Coleman is not alone in his use of violence against reptilian changelings. In January 2014, Zakiya, Latrice Avery, and a friend had come to believe that evil spirits were jumping in and out of her four children's bodies. Apparently prayer wouldn't work, so they took to trying to stab the children when they were in a possessed state. They killed a one-year-old and a two-year-old. The older siblings, a five-year-old and an eight-year-old, were also stabbed, but survived their wounds. Dijon Anderson and Dawn Elaine Coleman. These are two women from Indiana who in 2022 killed Anderson's five-year-old son, Cairo, stuffed his body in a suitcase and left him in the woods. According to social media posts, they believe the boy was the vessel of a 100-year-old demon. I'm going to read an actual post from Dawn Coleman that sheds light on their thoughts. Just because the avatar is of what we call a child does not mean that it is actually a child. There are beings that are here that are not supposed to be here, that pick avatars to hide behind, to play roles, to steal energy, and to ruin lives. You better check to see if the children that you think are children actually have souls, or if they're not malevolent beings. Magic is real, curses are real, and there are some very powerful evil beings that will curse your womb, and then some. Nothing is what it seems, and we are catering to evil beings and children avatars that aren't even children. The avatar Coleman refers to as the child's body, but remember in this case, it's different than possession. It is embodied evil, like Bridget Cleary, Martin Luther's changeling, or Chad Daybell's zombies. Of course, when I lay out all these beliefs, one possibility is that it's the supernatural that is the problem. Of course, I don't believe religion or supernatural belief is inherently good or inherently bad. I think religion gives individuals meaning and pulls together groups, but it's also power and can be used to bring about wonderful things related to human advancement and liberation, or it can be used for evil causes like the things we're discussing here. When considering murder, I suspect that supernatural belief is rarely the primary motivation of violence. And I know I'm biased. I hold supernatural beliefs, including charismatic and unpopular supernatural beliefs. Many, many Americans do, and we aren't more likely to be violent people. At least, I don't think we are. It's important in the murders we have talked about today, we could easily point to more secular and human motivations for wanting to harm these family members than a command from God or a belief that they were really someone else. Even if these were sincerely held beliefs, the underlying motivation was actually something else. Maybe Michael Cleary killed his wife in March 1895 because he believed she was a fairy, but maybe he was actually an abusive man eager to rid himself of his wife. Chad and Lori Daybell maybe orchestrated the killing of their victims because they thought they were zombies, but we already know they wanted to start a life together, and they viewed these people as impediments to their happiness. With Michael Cleary, the Daybells, and the others, supernatural belief did aid in creating accomplices and supporters. There's no question about that. Whatever you think about the motivations of these murders, I hope this episode has helped you to think of the murders of Charles Vallow, Tammy Daybell, Tylee Ryan, and J.J. Vallow as part of a much longer history of violence justified by changeling beliefs or possession. Even as I wrestle with the supernatural aspect of these crimes, one thing is certain. These are murders that were brought about through a deliberate effort of dehumanization. Here, supernatural beliefs are used to order or perpetrate murder based on the idea that the victim is not really your family member, not really human at all. And of course, this conversation, that violence comes about and is justified through dehumanization, is a much, much larger lens by which violence has occurred throughout human history, whether it's based on supernatural beliefs or political ones. But I can imagine you asking the obligatory question at this point. Chris, you've spent a lot of time talking about belief in fairies, reptilians, and other doubles that mirror Chad and Lori's zombies. Does that mean you don't think there's any significance to the LDS-ness of Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow? Sadly, no, I can't say that. While I think there is nothing inherently violent about the Latter-day Saint tradition, it's true at this point, a whole series of LDS villains have entered public consciousness through popular culture. Think about just the most popular examples. The bombings of document forger Mark Hoffman, the sickening murders of the Lafferty brothers, the assassinations ordered by Irvell LeBaron and his followers. the abduction of Elizabeth Smart by David Mitchell, and the terrible abuses perpetrated by Warren Jeffs. It makes sense for someone to approach the Daybell murders with these other villains in mind. We Latter-day Saints have had our extremists. There's also an overtly Latter-day Saint dimension to these murders, and specifically in the lead-up and aftermath of the Charles Vallow killing. Those involved reference the figure of Nephi from the Book of Mormon. Lori told Alex that they were to be Nephis. Afterwards, in a text message, Alex described Charles Vallow's death as a Nephi and Laban ending. So what is the story of Nephi and Laban in the Book of Mormon? Nephi and his brothers left Jerusalem after their father faced religious persecution for declaring his visions of a coming destruction. They returned to Jerusalem to acquire a copy of the scriptures recorded on a set of brass plates. These plates were owned by a powerful military figure named Laban. The brothers first visit Laban and ask for the plates. Not surprising, he sends them packing. Next, they return with all the family's wealth that they had abandoned in the city in hopes that Laban will part with the plates at a price. Laban decides to kill the brothers and take their possessions anyway. Fortunately, they're able to escape. It's then that Nephi decides to return. Later that evening, middle of the night, the story is actually told from Nephi's perspective. He writes that he went towards Laban's home, quote, led by the Spirit, not knowing beforehand what I should do, end quote. When he gets there, he finds a drunk Laban passed out in the street. Nephi draws Laban's sword, and then he has this back and forth with God about whether he should kill him or not. Nephi reluctantly beheads Laban, dresses in his clothes, and is then able to get the plates and flee to his father's camp. As a Latter-day Saint, I can't help but think that a comparison between the killings that Chad and Lori orchestrated and the killing of Laban is a stretch. First, Laban was an actual threat to Nephi and his family. He had already tried to kill the brothers and had stolen their possessions. Second, according to the Book of Mormon, Laban's beheading was not premeditated, even if it was commanded by God. And even while I make these distinctions, I acknowledge this isn't my favorite story. Latter-day Saints love the figure of Nephi, who is constantly obedient to God's call. But we don't love this scene. Of course, that clarification doesn't really matter. The fact is that while all the zombie talk is foreign to Latter-day Saint thought, this reference to Nephi and Laban cannot be ignored. And yes, other LDS murderers have pointed to this story to justify their crimes. This includes the Lafferty brothers from Under the Banner of Heaven fame and Jeffrey Lundgren, a member of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who killed a family of five in Kirtland, Ohio in 1989. So in conclusion, the Daybell killings certainly have LDS elements to them. However, I don't believe there's anything inherently violent in my faith. We certainly can put together a small list of Latter-day Saint extremists who have abused their children and have done so while believing they were justified by a fringe interpretation of their faith. This, of course, includes Jody Hildebrandt and Ruby Frankie, who have made the news since we've learned about Chad Daybell and Lori Vallow's murders. But while researching these murders and researching this project, I've discovered that there's widespread domestic violence based on supernatural ideas, including what we've discussed here today, and I learned just how widespread neglect and abuse that leads to child homicide is in the United States. While this is obvious, I'll say it to make sure we take this in. This is not a, quote, Mormon thing. Over 1,800 kids die from neglect and abuse each year in the United States. What a completely terrifying statistic. If you suspect a child is not safe, you need to do something. As a Latter-day Saint, I take seriously this quote from a sometimes controversial document entitled The Family, A Proclamation to the World. It reads, "We warn that individuals who violate covenants of chastity, who abuse spouse or offspring, or who fail to fulfill family responsibilities will one day stand accountable before God." Of course, such a statement applies directly to Chad and Lori, despite their odd insistence of their righteousness. Thank you for joining me today. The next episode is on Latter-day Saint apocalypticism, the internet communities that propped up the more fringe side of these beliefs. And in telling you this story, I'm also going to tell you how Chad Daybell came to believe he was someone special. We'll see you next week.